I'm Gavin Clark. I'm the software editor of The Register, and I'm here today with Mary Jo Foley, and we're talking about Microsoft and obviously Bill Gates, who's left the company now. You know, Mary Jo is the author of Microsoft 2.0, How Microsoft Plans to Stay Relevant in the Post-Gates Era. Hello, Mary Jo.
Hi, Gavin.
How's it going?
It's good, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, pleasure. But you've been covering Microsoft for about 25 years now, is that the case?
Yep, believe it or not, I was just a child when I started. I actually interviewed Bill Gates for the first time in 1984.
Really?
And yep, that I was on my first job out of college, and I was working for a magazine called Electronic Business, and they had assigned me to cover hardware at the time. But I was really interested in trying to learn about the software industry, and so I pitched to them that I write a cover story about a little software company that nobody really knew, named Microsoft.
Right.
And so I had to talk my editor into it because he wasn't real keen on that idea, since he was a big believer that the future of tech journalism was writing about capacitors and resistors.
Right.
But he ended up agreeing, and he sent me to Comdex, and that's the first time I interviewed Bill Gates.
How did you get that first interview? Was it easy?
It was really easy because at that point, Microsoft was really hungry for press coverage, and even if you were a little nobody like me, it didn't matter. They just wanted anybody to talk to them and write about the company.
Right, and what did you talk to him about?
Well, I tried to talk to him about Microsoft and kind of what their strategy was and their business model, but as many people have heard about Bill Gates, he wasn't the nicest guy to interview. And especially back in those days, before he had had his charm school press training, he was definitely a tough interview. He kept looking around while I was interviewing him, and like you could tell he was just not interested in doing the interview or focused on anything I was asking. And I got a few of those infamous Bill Gates comments, "That was the stupidest question I ever heard," thrown into my interview. So it was tough, you know, for somebody just starting out in the field and kind of trying to cover a company that she didn't really know that much about.
And do you remember, like, what was the subject, what kind of questions you asked him at the time?
It was a long time ago, so I don't really remember the exact questions. But, you know, it was more like, you know, what was Microsoft trying to accomplish, and what were some of the products that they hoped to come out with? Just kind of generic questions.
Do you think, looking back today, you know, or maybe it's a stretch, but did they achieve some of what he maybe said in that interview? Do you think they delivered, or they still got a way to go?
Well, you know, the thing that Microsoft set out to do when it started was to help put a computer on every desktop and every home. So now that there are a billion Windows PCs out there, you can say they really did help accomplish the goal that they set for the company when they started it.
Right. So, you know, you kind of talked a bit about in your book, you talked about the cult of Bill Gates, and, you know, as you mentioned, he's known for being famously rude and in you know, not very well disposed to people asking what he thinks are lame questions. Just explain them. What was the cult of Bill Gates at Microsoft, and how did it manifest itself?
Well, it was really interesting to get to cover Microsoft over the years, because at first they were kind of a little nobody and nobody really cared that much about them, And as time went on and Gates became richer and Microsoft became more well-known, you know, it got tougher and tougher to get access to the company and the executives there. But at the same time, it was fun to watch kind of how Microsoft morphed from almost like a collegiate dorm-like atmosphere to more of a real credible conglomerate that it is today.
Mm.
I remember like going to company shareholder meetings back in the day when people would pull their kids out of public school in Seattle because they wanted to get Bill Gates' autograph, you know, and they'd have their kids in the audience at the shareholders meeting, and when it was over, they'd run up to the stage and get Gates' autograph, you know, and, you know, those kind of things, those little memories like that where, you know, even when Gates didn't have security around him, which he didn't for a long time, not until fairly recently, it was really interesting to see, you know, just a lot of people in Seattle just kind of ignored him. Like when he walked down the street, people would see, oh, yeah, that's Bill Gates. And he'd just walk by and he'd just be wearing like some old windbreaker. You'd never think, like, there goes the richest man in the world, you know?
Right.
Well, I mean, so it was cool.
Do you think, I mean, I think there's a tendency in corporate life, especially in America, to kind of really venerate the kind of the CEO character. Do you think that what Gates was getting was typical, or do you think he had something a little extra that people wanted to get close to Gates?
Well, I think, you know, he's always been kind of like a, at least to the Microsoft employees, like a folk hero, you know, inside the company.
Right.
And for a number of years, like in the late 80s, early 90s, people at Microsoft were so enamored of him, so many of the employees, that they'd even try to, like, dress like Bill Gates. A lot of people were wearing their hair the way Gates was, kind of on, like, that messy
right.
mullet kind of thing. and wearing the same kind of glasses. I mean, I even saw people rocking back and forth the way Gates used to in the old days in
right.
his chair when he'd get really intense about something. And it was just really interesting because for nerds and geeks, like, he was their guy. He was an example of geek made good.
Right.
And I think a lot of people really kind of associated themselves with him and really believed, like, hey, if he can do it, so can I.
Right. So it's interesting that that obviously now Ray Ozzie has kind of taken over. Gates is Mansour's chief software architect at Microsoft, and Ray's obviously well known as being the inventor of Lotus Notes, which most people hate, and you know, most people are forced to use. What do you think? You know, what kind of legacy does Gates leave for someone like Ozzie? You know, what has Ozzie's impact been at Microsoft so far, would you say? If any.
Well, you know, it's interesting, a couple interesting points about them hiring Ray Ozzie. One is, you know, everybody kind of knows the story now that Gates and Ballmer both said they had wanted to hire Ray Ozzie for years, and they had always been trying to find a way to get him to come to Microsoft. But recently, there was an interesting a little aside over at eWeek where they actually had some sources tell them that Grady Booch might have been Microsoft's first choice for chief software architect, and that they had made an offer to Grady and that he had turned them down.
Right.
Now, I can't confirm or deny that, but I think that's really interesting if you think about that, like that Gates was looking for somebody to take his role, and not necessarily, you know, Ray Ozzie, but somebody who really knew the modeling industry. And you know, Grady went on to do a lot of that stuff for IBM, but it's just kind of poses an interesting question, like, were they looking for Ray Ozzie, or were they looking for somebody who had a certain set of qualities that they wanted to become the new chief software architect at Microsoft?
What do you think Booch would have offered that maybe Ozzie hasn't got or would have offered differently?
Well, I mean, they're both guys who are seen as tech visionaries in their own areas, you know. I am not as familiar with Grady Booch as I am with Ray Ozzie, just because Ozzie's been at Microsoft and I've had more of a chance to kind of watch him and study him, although not to talk to him, because so far Microsoft really hasn't let him out to talk publicly much to the press. You know, in my book, I kind of wonder aloud whether that's because they didn't want Ozzie to overstep Gates while Gates was still there, or if it's more just Ozzie really doesn't want to be in the limelight and is a real behind-the-scenes guy. And if it's the latter, I wonder, you know, whether Ozzie's going to kind of step it up and change now that Gates is gone, because I think Microsoft really needs somebody to be the public tech champion of the company. I mean, they've got Steve Ballmer as kind of the sales guy, and they've got the three presidents around Ballmer, you know, Robbie Bach, Jeff Rakes, and I'm drawing a blank on who the third is, and Kevin Johnson.
Right.
You know, they're all more sales guys than they are tech guys. And I think Microsoft really needs somebody to be like the public face, to speak at conferences and kind of lay out the road ahead kind of vision thing that Gates used to do. And if, you know, if Ozzie doesn't really want to fill that role, my question is, who will at Microsoft? You know, will Craig Mundy, who's the chief research officer there, kind of rise up and be the new public face? And what will that mean in terms of, you know, the chief software architect's not the guy giving the vision statement to the public? So there's a lot of questions how the management stuff's going to shake out there right now.
Do you think Ozzie, what would you say is the biggest difference, if it's all between Ozzie and Gates, either from a, you know, where they are or in terms of their visionary status or what they've achieved? Yeah, and also, is it possible for even Ozzie to even fill those shoes that Gates has left behind?
Ozzie said himself in a couple of interviews I've read that he knows he is no Bill Gates, and he knows he can't fill Gates' shoes. And, I mean, that's a fair statement. I mean, who could, really? The guy was the founder of Microsoft, and, I mean, he's epitomized the company for the past 33 years. So it's pretty tough to come in and be the new guy, you know? But that said, you know, I think Ozzie and Gates, they both are guys who understand, like, the need for a big picture vision and I think they both have inspire a lot of loyalty among the developers at Microsoft, because the people who report to Ozzie are very loyal to him and really believe that he has a vision that's going to make Microsoft matter in the future.
Right.
But there's, you know, there's a contingent inside Microsoft who some of the people I've talked to also have their doubts about him, because, you know, right now what you've got inside Microsoft are members of the old guard and members of the new guard, and they're kind of setting up camps, almost like the old Silverberg-Alchin feud from years ago there.
Right.
Except different camps now. Now you've got the camp that wants to kind of keep things the way they are and really keep the focus on Windows and Office and not let Microsoft stray from those two core products.
Yeah.
But then you've got the team kind of more on the Aussie side, the Windows Live side, who are saying, you know, guys, we can't keep living off these royalties from Windows and Office forever, because the industry is changing and we need to get ahead of the curve.
I think, can you just remind us, Silverberg and Alchin, what was that kind of dust up about?
Well, that was back in the old pre-antitrust days when Brad Silverberg, who was heading up Internet Explorer at the time, wanted Microsoft to keep Internet Explorer separate from Windows, because he believed Microsoft needed to kind of emerge as a standards champion and really focus on the web more. And Jim Alchin, who was the head of the Windows business at the time, was more in the camp saying, if we let IE kind of go out there and become separate from Windows, we're giving away our crown jewels, which are Windows, and we're making it too easy for people to not use Windows. And so it was quite a political battle between the two. In fact, former Wall Street reporter David Bank wrote a whole book on this feud, and I think it was called Breaking Windows. It was a really interesting book. But in the end, Silverberg lost out to Alchin, and Silverberg ended up leaving Microsoft.
Right, and Alchin obviously was one of the people in charge of Windows Vista, really, at the end, wasn't he? And that kind of went very well for them.
Yeah, not so well.
So just shifting focus a little bit, we tackled Ozzie. Ballmer, you've also met as well. Characterize Steve Ballmer for us, and, you know, and your impressions about where he is and you know, where he could take Microsoft.
Right now, Ballmer has become a very polarizing figure at Microsoft. And the reason I say that is there is a very vocal contingent, especially outside the company, not so much inside, but more on the outside, who thinks Ballmer should also retire and they should kind of clean house of the old guard and like start fresh with all new management at the top. And a lot of people blame Microsoft's stagnating stock price on Ballmer, and they say every time Ballmer opens his mouth and says something controversial about Linux or Microsoft's online systems business or Yahoo, that the stock tanks and, you know, all hell breaks loose. So, you know, he's not the most popular guy on the outside, but inside, I think he's got a reputation as a guy who's not afraid to make fun of himself, and a guy who's, you know, just like he seems kind of on stage when you see him charging around yelling developers, developers, developers.
Yeah.
I mean, he really is kind of like that. But he's also, from what I've heard from people who've reported to him, a very tough guy himself. Like, you know, Gates has the reputation as being kind of like the hard ass guy, but Ballmer is no soft guy. And, I've heard some pretty interesting stories, not just the famous story about him supposedly throwing a chair at Mark Lukowski when he left to join Google.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot of other stories about Ballmer really, you know, yelling and carrying on when he felt like things weren't right or people weren't prepared or the numbers weren't what he had expected. So he's definitely not a pushover.
I've got to stop there. So can you talk about the stuff you've heard about Von Bomber's, like, you know, fiery temper? Does he throw chairs frequently? Does he kind of do people leave because of Bomber?
Well, I've never seen him throw a chair.
Right.
I remember though one time when I was on campus, I don't remember the exact circumstances of this, but some ruling had just come down about antitrust. And I was there when I was working for PC Week with a bunch of other editors from the publication. And we were interviewing Ballmer at the time. And somebody slipped into the conference room and told him what had been decided in the case. And he started pounding the table and yelling. I mean, just his face got so red. I was like, man, I think the guy's going to have a heart attack. And he was so angry. He had to, like, go out in the hall and, like, just yell. I mean, and I was like, wow, you know, impressive. But, you know, he's a guy who gets really fired up about the company. I mean, yeah. You know, when he yelled on video, I love this company. Mm. You know, this is a guy who's had to have an operation on his vocal cords because he yelled so loud at a sales meeting. I mean, this is a true story. And I mean, he's just as crazy and kind of outlandish as he seems. But but I think he's also I think it was in the New York Times I read this. There was a profile of Steve Ballmer about a year ago, and they also mentioned that he I think he scored a perfect 800 on his math SAT when he was in college. And I mean, the guy is – everybody who knows him at the management level at Microsoft says, this guy – is a mathematical genius. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody thinks of, like, Gates as the smart guy and Ballmer as the sales guy, but actually Steve is pretty smart too.
Right. So tell us, do you think from your impressions of meeting the trio of Ozzie, you know, Gates and Ballmer, the combination of Ballmer and Ozzie and the combination of Ballmer and Gates, is there, you know, will it be the same, Ozzie and Ballmer? Is it as powerful? Does it have strengths or weaknesses? Is it better than or less than the combination of Ballmer and Gates, do you think?
Well, I think it can never be the same.
Yeah.
I mean, because Ballmer and Gates were together for 28 or so years.
Mm.
I mean, you know, they went to college together. They really have spent so much time and kind of like have become the dynamic duo. Like Steve Ballmer said last week in the town meeting for employees when Bill was leaving, he said, you know, I can complete the guy's sentences.
Mm.
And Ozzie is just a much quieter, more reserved guy. And I would guess even if Ballmer respects him, you know, even half as much as he respected Gates, it's still going to be a very different dynamic.
Yeah. So, in your book, you were talking about, you know, one interesting thing I thought was how, you know, the Microsoft brass is adamant, is not, you don't feel the same adamant about keeping Microsoft together as a whole. And you talked about one of the spin outs around the Halo business as well. Explain that a little bit. Where has this come from, this kind of sense of maybe not so much a need to keep the unit together, and how far does it go up the stack? I mean, all the way to the top, or, you know, the less important parts of the business, or what are you sensing? What are you hearing?
Well, if you remember, you probably do because you've been covering this as long as I have almost.
Yeah.
You know, back when in 2000, when the Department of Justice ruled that Microsoft had abused its monopoly power in desktop operating systems, Judge Jackson said that Microsoft should be broken up into two companies, an operating system company and everything else.
Mm.
And Microsoft fought that tooth and nail, and it ended up being overturned. But they argued that there's no way Microsoft should be separated and divided because it was going to make the company weaker.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the near decade since then, a lot has changed. And one thing that's changed is Microsoft has gotten huge. I mean, there are over 90,000 employees now.
Yeah.
And they're having trouble figuring out how to stay agile because they're so big. And one way they've done it to some extent is to allow specific teams to kind of go their own way and incubate and then kind of come back into the company and become part of Microsoft again. And a couple of examples of that are, that's how the Xbox team started, and Zune also.
Yeah.
And people point to that saying, see, it can be done. You let these teams kind of go off and be in a secret location and have their own card keys and not really be part of Microsoft. And then when they come back in, we can reabsorb them and make them part of the whole.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I wasn't sure how far Microsoft might go with this until I just read a Wall Street Journal article last week, actually, where they had gotten a hold of a memo that Ballmer wrote a year or two ago, where he asked that very question, like, how decentralized should we have Microsoft become in the future? And so there's now all this kind of rekindled speculation. Are they going to break Microsoft up themselves?
Mm.
Are they going to do more things like they did with the Xbox and Zune and let more teams kind of go off and incubate and then come back?
Mm.
I mean, they're basically, what they're trying to do at Microsoft right now is figure out a way to stay agile and to get more innovative, because, you know, for all their talk about what a great innovator they are, I think in their heart, the people at Microsoft know they haven't really got that reputation out in the business as being a leading innovator.
Mm.
And they're really trying to find a way to kind of quantify and make innovation more repeatable.
Well, that's the constant, you know, quest of the IT industry, isn't it? To kind of make innovation kind of repeatable and make it less of a kind of a an art, more of a science. I think, yeah. What do you think, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on at Microsoft these days, maybe more than ever than there was back in the 90s. You know, there's a lot of different projects going on. Some people say too many projects going on. From what you've seen, meeting them, talking to the softies, and you know, just going over what they're doing in the research labs, do you think there's too much going on, and what do you think is, like, you know, what have you seen that's most interesting potentially to our readers? What projects are you hearing about? I mean, you mentioned Horizon and Cosmos, and you're talking, referring to some stuff quite recently, I believe, today. Tell us a little bit about what you think is most interesting or most has most potential.
Well, first I'd say I know Microsoft does need to diversify, and I understand that. And I mean, obviously Ballmer and the management there really understand that. And that's why they're not just putting all their eggs in the Windows and the Office basket. They're trying all these new things, everything from like gaming consoles to MP3 players to even now they're in the healthcare business with this new offering they have called Health Vault.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's good that they're diversifying and they're trying a lot of different businesses and kind of seeing what sticks and what's going to create their next billion-dollar business. But at the same time, I and a number of other people who watch the company are wondering if they aren't kind of spreading themselves too thin.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Microsoft keeps saying the common thread among all these investments is that they all encompass, to some degree, software. Like, even if software isn't operating system software or application software, there's something like an embedded software core or a service that is connected to software. So that's how they rationalize
yeah.
how all this, you know, huge number of projects that they've got going right now.
Right.
I can't help but wonder if they were going back to the idea of cutting up the company, if it might not make more sense to cut Microsoft into an enterprise and a consumer company, because
right.
if you look at where they're going, they've got a whole bunch of consumer-oriented investments, like more towards the consumer electronics space, and then they've got a whole bunch of, you know, their existing investments, which they also are growing in the business/enterprise space. And it seems to me like those two sets of goals and needs and customers, sure, they overlap to some extent, but they have pretty different sets of priorities and needs. So
do you see any actually kind of solid structural changes inside Microsoft that are actually making any of this new stuff come to fruition? Because one of Microsoft's biggest, like, you know, weaknesses is always constant rebranding. Like MSN, you know, became like, you know, Windows Live, for example, and then it became, then it's MSN again. So are they just moving the pieces around, or are they actually making some solid structural changes that make sure they can actually harness innovation again?
I think they're making some changes that are going to help them become more agile. You know, just about, I think it was like 3 months ago, they decided to have separate consumer and business sales forces inside of the Platforms and Services Division. And before, there really had never been two separate independent sales forces. So to me, that shows that they know they can't be everything to everybody.
Mm.
And on the branding side, they, you know, as much as they've already rebranded around Windows Live, it's something that they're going to have to keep at, because it's still a horrible branding mess over there. And I mean, if you just even look at search, for example, like if you ask people, do you know you have to go to www.live.com to get to Microsoft search engine? I think the majority of Americans and people outside of America too would say no.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just, it's not a brand that's working for them. And we keep hearing rumors, me and other people who cover Microsoft, that they're going to rebrand search
right.
again. They've been trying to clear up the branding mess a little bit by saying everything that's branded with the word live is a consumer offering, and every service that's branded with the word online is a business offering. But that's kind of esoteric, and I don't think most people get that they've done that, even though that's a good step.
Well, we've been here before already with .NET, haven't we, where everything was .NET,
yeah.
and then they retracted, and everything, only some things were .NET.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're going to see that same thing. I mean, if you even look at Live Mesh, I mean, it's Live Mesh. It's not Windows Live Mesh. You know, so they're playing around with, like, how to use the word live and when to use it, when not to use it, when to couple it with Windows, when not to.
I mean, is this the heart of the issue, really? I mean, how they're kind of confusing branding with innovation, and whereas some tech companies are coming up with good ideas and putting them out there, Microsoft is trying to find ways of, you know, of communicating some of its ideas. I mean, do you think they can actually get past this kind of obsession with the marketing focus and get back to the technology innovation?
Well, you know what I'd say to that, and I know a lot of people are going to say I'm a Microsoft apologist for saying what I'm about to say, but Microsoft actually has come up with some things in the online services space first, but they don't get the credit for it.
Such as?
They can't figure it out. Like here's an example. When I remember recently when Google opened up its APIs and started talking about, you know, we're going to make our APIs more open, everyone's like, wow, this is the end. This is it. Everybody's going to, like, go to Google now. But it's been 2 years since Windows Live APIs have been open, and nobody knows that they're open. And like, you have to really dig into dev.live.com to find the API page, which explains the terms and conditions, which are actually very simple once you look at them. And so, you know, but you ask Microsoft, like, so what do you have to say about Google opening its APIs? Nothing. Instead of saying, you know, hey, we did this 2 years ago. No, you know, you can't even get a comment out of them because they're so conscious of not wanting to be compared to Google and Yahoo.
So what's the fault here? What's the problem here? Why is it that, you know, Microsoft can come out saying 2 years ago and it goes unnoticed, and Google just, like, launches it 2 days ago and people think the sky is falling in and this is great? You know, is it just because Google's now seen as cooler, which is where Microsoft was 10 years ago, or is it something different here?
Yeah, I'd say it's because Google right now is the golden child, and, you know, anything they do is held up as, like, earth-shattering and unbelievable, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But Microsoft's not doing itself any favors by kind of making what it does have really hard to find and very esoteric. You know, this is actually part of the Ray Ozzie complaint that I'm hearing among some people. You know, Ozzie's a big believer that Microsoft has been too open, I hear. Mm-hmm. Now, I can't get him to say this because I can't get an interview with him, but, you know, what I hear from other people is Ozzie's a big advocate of, like, let's try to do more like Apple and keep things more secret and more quiet until we really actually have something to announce.
Right.
Let's not do the pre-announcements that Microsoft has gotten in so much trouble for in the past.
Right.
As you know, that's good and bad. Like, it's good because then you're not setting false expectations. But it's also bad because then you kind of lose mind share with your customers and potential customers because they think you've got nothing in an area where you might be, like, you know, poised to launch something. You know, here's an example of that. You know, Amazon has always talked about, for all the stuff it's doing with the Elastic Cloud and how it's allowing developers to host projects on its servers. Well, Microsoft supposedly has something like this too.
Right.
Which is codenamed Zurich, I believe. Again, I can't get anybody at Microsoft to talk about that, but...
So Zurich is what is, like, a cloud hosting service?
I think the way I've heard it described is it's Microsoft's application platform and .NET brought to the cloud.
Right.
Now, what that actually means and what that's going to look like and when it's going to ship, who knows?
Right.
But, you know, instead of kind of doing what the old Microsoft would do, which would be like, hey, we got something coming, and here's our platform vision, and here's some slides, and we're going to show you what we got... they're just not talking. And so people are saying, oh, look, Microsoft doesn't get it. And they don't get cloud computing, and they're just out in left field. They're going to be left behind. And so that, you know, that's also damaging to them because people will go off and do all their cloud hosting with Amazon and not even consider Microsoft because they think Microsoft's not in the market anymore.
Right. Can they get over this at all, do you think? Or, you know, are you seeing any evidence that they can actually change things? I mean, are they fundamentally going to be an uncool company? Again, it's like 10 years ago, everyone was writing for Windows 95 or whatever, and it was all good. But now it's, you know, it's gone the other way. Google, you know, Microsoft is now seen as being yesterday's company. Or is that just, you know, can it recapture that innovation and the mindshare?
I guess that's like the $64,000 question.
Yeah.
You know, for all the coolness factor that Google benefits from and that Apple benefits from as well. If you really look at what businesses are doing, at least, a lot of businesses still are very tied to Microsoft, you know, whether they want to be or not, or whether it's like a conscious choice or just by default. You know, it's funny because everyone's like, oh, Apple's making all these inroads into businesses and Microsoft's losing out. Well, Apple has 2% of the business market.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got to be realistic about this. You know, when everyone says everyone's using Google Docs or everyone's putting their data in the cloud, when I talk to businesses and developers, that's not the truth.
Yeah.
That's just the perception, you know. And I think, you know, a lot of people have kind of written off Microsoft's whole software plus services strategy and saying it's just, oh, Microsoft trying to, you know, preserve Windows and Office and not come into the future. But actually, if you talk to developers and business users, at least, that's what they want them to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're not ready to put their data in the cloud, and they don't want to be forced to put their data in the cloud before they're ready.
Right. So tell me, just briefly, you mentioned Zurich. Are you seeing, I mentioned Horizon, Cosmos. Are there any kind of like cool projects or good projects for developers they should, you know, you've seen kicking around in the Microsoft labs that you think developers or, you know, enterprises might be interested in? You know, they'll either, you know, help them in their job or maybe help, you know, Microsoft extend or enhance what it's already got or whatever?
Well, I think, you know, at this year's PDC, which is going to be in late October, we're going to hear a lot about some of these projects that we just have code names for at this point. You know, we're going to hear about the Live Mesh SDK and the platform, which is kind of like the missing piece of Live Mesh that we don't know about so far. You know, how does a third-party developer write a Live Mesh application?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we're going to hear a lot about that. We're supposedly going to hear more about Oslo, which is Microsoft's modeling platform.
Yeah.
And part of that is the new programming language that they're working on that's codenamed D.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to hear a lot more about that at the PDC, and that should be very interesting to people who are trying to develop around .NET and for .NET as it goes forward. I think we're going to hear more about Zurich and what that means to put .NET in the cloud. And I think we might also hear about another code name I've written a little bit about called Red Dog. Red Dog is supposedly the web OS from Microsoft, whatever that actually means.
Right.
So it's supposed to be, from what I've heard, the operating system that's going to power the back-end services infrastructure that Microsoft is building. So.
Right.
You know, if you're a company who wants to host your data with Microsoft Exchange, hosted by Microsoft, that would run on top of Red Dog, supposedly.
So, you know, obviously these are big claims and slightly with a fair amount of kind of like supposition and some slideware coming out from the Microsoft people. But, you know, we had a lot of big claims around Windows Vista. Are you from when you speak to the softies every day over there, or do you sense any sense of irony that maybe they're promising too much again, or a sense of things have changed sufficiently after the Vista debacle that they're going to get it right next time?
Well, I think, you know, on the Windows side of the house, now that you've got Steven Sinofsky running things, it's going to be a very different place, because he is a guy who is really focused on under-promising and over-delivering.
Right.
I always say that backwards. you know, so he's going to make sure that Windows 7, when it ships, is going to be ready, and the ecosystem's going to be ready, and there aren't going to be driver compatibility problems. I mean, it's going to be all buttoned up when Windows 7 comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're also going to surprisingly see Windows 7 come out on time. I would not be surprised to see Windows 7 in late 2009. I know everybody who's ever covered Microsoft can't believe they'll ever ship an operating system on time. But I think if I were going to bet on it, I would bet that thing's going to be out on time.
Why is that? Because they just learned lessons from Vista, or they made changes to the way they build product these times, or things just can't be as bad as Vista?
Well, I think mostly because they're not going to bite off more than they can chew this time.
Yeah.
Like, Windows 7 is not going to be a major upgrade to Windows Vista. I mean, it's going to be a minor upgrade. It's going to have a definable set of features. The main thing it's going to try to do is make sure everything that they had in Vista finally works.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to have a new kernel. I mean, there's going to be some new things in it, like, you know, more touch, multi-touch support, and probably some support for new peripherals that we haven't seen before, more compatibility with Windows Mobile, and, you know, they're kind of smaller things, not some of the huge things that were promised for Vista that ended up getting cut. So you know, I think they have learned some lessons, and I think they're really going to try to be more circumspect about what they promise compared to what they deliver. You know, not just in Windows, but, you know, with Ray Ozzie being the chief software architect now, he's also a guy who is really focused on let's not promise more than we can deliver. I think you're going to see a real emphasis change for Microsoft in the next few years in terms of not promising the world. I mean, these are all huge things. They're talking about Oslo and Zurich and Red Dog and all these things. But I think they're going to be a little more kind of more, what would I say, more controlled about how they release the information and the code.
What's the kind of the temperature inside Microsoft these days, amongst the softies, the people who build the software? Are they kind of feeling good from your conversations with people? Are they feeling good about being employees at Microsoft? Are they feeling bullish about being employees at Microsoft? Would they rather wish they were working for Google these days?
Well, I think a lot of the ones who wish they were working for Google have gone and tried it already.
Yeah.
And some have come back to Microsoft. Some are still out there and happy that they left Microsoft. I think different teams, there's different temperatures on different teams. And right now, I think a tough team to be on at Microsoft is Windows. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, if you think about it, if you just spent the past 6-7 years of your life building something that everybody is always bad-mouthing, it's not real fun to be on that team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything that they're doing is under a lot of scrutiny. Steven Sinofsky is supposedly quite the task manager, and I don't think it would be a place I'd want to work if I was picking where to work at Microsoft.
Right.
You know, but other teams seem to be kind of more jazzed about what the possibilities are. You know, the team under Sam Ramji that does a lot of stuff around open source and runs the Port 25 blog at Microsoft, they're pretty jazzed right now because there seems to be, you know, more open source companies actually talking to Microsoft and not just kind of vilifying them. So it's kind of a good time that where they feel like they can change industry perceptions of Microsoft in that space. We'll see.
Do you think the wind is kind of in their sails slightly? But from what you know of what's going on there, do you think that you know, the open source guys can only go so far, that at the end of the day they still hit the glass ceiling of the Windows and the Office division and Balmer's kind of like strange behavior of like kind of throwing grenades out on intellectual property?
I think that's always going to be a worry. I mean, if you look back at what happened to them, they were kind of on a roll a couple years ago, and everybody was kind of saying, "Oh, Microsoft's really changed its attitude towards open source." And then suddenly they come out with the thing saying, "You know, we believe that open source violates 235 of our patents." Well, that kind of set them back a long way from all the progress they had made to that point.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, with Balmer there, he definitely is a guy who doesn't believe that open source is what Microsoft should be doing, and it's going to take a lot of convincing by Ozzy and other people to change his mind. I don't know if they can change his mind.
Okay, Mary Jo. Well, I think that's kind of all we got time for, but it's been really good talking to you.
Thanks, Gavin.
Just tell me the book is Microsoft 2.0, how Microsoft plans to stay relevant in the post-Gates era. How do people kind of get hold of a copy?
Well, you can buy it on Amazon. You can buy it at Barnes & Noble. It's out there in the industry right now, and it's pretty widespread. So I hope everybody can pick up a copy. And if I see you at a show, I'd be happy to sign it for you.
Great. All right, Mary Jo. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Kevin.
Cheers. Bye.